Welcome to the Student Paramedic Podcast. Welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today is a very exciting episode. We have on our MICA flight paramedic, Darren Hodge. He's going to give us a little bit of insight into what it is like to be a flight paramedic. Also have a chat to him about his book. So he has a book called A Life on the Line, and we've both read it, Brayden and I, and we love it. So I'm sitting today with Brayden.
Hey guys, so we have Darren Hodge on. He happens to be a friend of mine. So Darren, introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Darren Hodge. I'm 54 and a MICA flight paramedic in one of the ambulance helicopters down in Victoria. So I've been a paramedic for 34 years and today I'm feeling every part of it. We've just come out of lockdown, so I've been to the gym and feeling sore everywhere.
Oh, that's good to hear. So you're a MICA flight paramedic down in Melbourne, Victoria. So could you just give a bit of detail into what you do in that role and what that role is like for the people at home?
Cool. So we have, a three-tiered system in Victoria. So we have our ambulance drivers and ambulance attendants who do work in the private sector. We have our advanced life support people. We have our MICA paramedics, and then we have the fourth tier, is the MICA flight paramedic group. We have five AW139 helicopters in Victoria and four King Air Super 200Bs. We have about 45 MICA flight paramedics in the state of Victoria. And the demographic for Victoria is that represents about 1% of our workforce. So we have about 4,500 paramedics. At the moment, our crew mix is one MICA flight paramedic, a pilot and a crewman, and our crewmen are medically trained. That will change. We're doing some trials at the moment with two-man crewing, and we haven't decided what that'll look like, whether it will be a doctor, registrar, perhaps two MICA paramedics. We're not sure. So we're going to do some trialing to see that. But the cognitive and workload for one person is probably just too great, and we need to follow suit of all the other states and have two clinicians on board.
I was going to say that's a very nice segue into what I read in your book is basically how much you have to go through cognitively and physically as well in that role when you're getting winched out and things don't go right. For example, losing your radios and things like that, and then having patients who are incredibly critical and having to take on board, okay, what do I do next? Like, that's a lot of cognitive overload. How do you cope with that?
I think managing cognitive burden, look, I'm fascinated by human factors, and I do a lot of talking around that. And a lot of the lessons I learned from the aviation industry, and managing cognitive burden and cognitive overload is really quite a defined art. And I think the people that I admire in my profession are the people who can manage that cognitive burden well. And I think there is, it's probably, if we could come back and visit in a whole session, there is some things that you can do as students to learn to become better about managing cognitive burden. Because the reality is that whatever you bring to a scene, and often in my role, I'm the clinical leader. And if you bring an air of calm, that's infectious. But conversely, if you bring panic or, you're frantic or you don't have a system, that is also contagious. And, I think one of the things that's perhaps not talked about overly in what we do as paramedics is coming in and bringing an air of calm and introducing a system. Now, cognitive burden and cognitive overload, I think, very few people would actually ever experience cognitive overload in their life. They might once or twice, but having those moments where you simply feel so overwhelmed, you just simply don't know what to do, is relatively rare. But as people in the health industry, that's something that we can experience. And there are some tools, some steps that we put in place to manage that. But essentially, the day that you start in your paramedic college, the system, the structure, the clinical approach, that's what gets you out of trouble when things get really hard. And we're involved in obviously the pointy end of going to some of the worst accidents and injuries, but perhaps the hardest work that we do on the ambulance helicopter is retrieving someone out of a small rural hospital. And when you have people that have multi-system failures and are critically unwell, there's no great magic panacea or magic bullet. The DRABC mnemonic is what we go to, and that clinical approach and structure is what you would use when you feel overwhelmed.
Yeah, so when you have that cognitive overdrive, when they're really on the brink of who you are and what you are, what do you go back to? Do you go back to like your crewman and your pilot that you have? Do you go back to your teachings, your skills? What do you go to when you're in that overdrive?
It's all system. It has to be system. And I mean, the thing about understanding cognitive overload is we all need to understand what happens to us individually when we have cognitive overload, because we all react a little bit differently. And some people become panicked, some people can yell and things. I become a quiet talker. And some of the common presentations when people have cognitive overload is they become silent. And, you know, some of you guys, when you've done your placements, might have been at big jobs when you're looking for leadership, you're looking to someone to give you direction when things are going badly, and the senior clinician is just fixed on a task or just stops communicating. And that's because he's having cognitive overload. In the book, I talk about a story of a GP physician who works down in my part of Victoria, and a lovely man. And he was hit by a car and he was incredibly critically injured. But when I arrived, I just walked in right as he was on the cusp of dying. And I was halfway through my systematic approach and he arrested. And the arrest was, it wasn't expected. He was combative and fighting. He was in hypovolemic shock, but he was also had a traumatic brain injury. And we gave him a procedural dose of ketamine to allow us to oxygenate him. And he went from, you know, having a very fast heart rate into cardiac arrest. And that happened at a moment when I didn't expect that, the introduction of the ketamine, and he went into cardiac arrest. And I had that moment of feeling absolutely overwhelmed. And so at that point, you can go into a panic, and because there are so many complicated and many, many tasks to be done, you've got a great big workforce. But I simply stopped, and I had that period of time. I don't know how long it was, but I simply felt overwhelmed, and I acknowledged that I was overwhelmed. So I just went back to DRABC and that systematic approach of primary survey, secondary survey. And then when you have that cognitive overload where you're so overwhelmed, you can't be analytical. So that left and right side of the brain, you lose that ability to be analytical, but you don't need to be analytical. You go back and follow your system, which is learnt behaviour, which is you guys have been learning since day one. And you follow that DRABC and all the priorities will fall out of that. And then what we do and how we build the case from that point of view is we look at our team and we want to exploit the skills of the people within the team. So we want our intensive care paramedics working within their skill set extension. We don't want them doing ALS tasks. If we've got a big ALS team, we want the ALS people doing the ALS tasks. We want the intensive care people doing the intensive care tasks. And in my role, we bring a very small additional skill set to the case presentation, but only I can do that. I can only do the ultrasound. I'm the only one who can do finger thoracostomy. So I want to do those things, and I want the intensive care paramedics to do the things like the RSI and get the IVs in and start administering blood and things. So when you have those moments of feeling so overwhelmed, if you fall back to structure, you'll never get it wrong. But it's what sometimes when paramedics do get it wrong is that they have things start spiraling out of control. They see a task, they go and attack it, they lose their situational awareness, they suffer from task focus, and then the patient has some degree of demise and they don't recognise it because they have lost that situational awareness, and it can end in disaster.
And obviously you're going to the most critical cases with this, and they are confronting. You've had to go back to the basics and everything and make sure you're going systematically. What happens afterwards? So you've gone to these really challenging cases. How do you cope mentally with these? Because I do remember you saying, either in a podcast or in the book, that you said, you know, the book was a bit of an outlet.
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges for you guys is resilience. And if you want to enter the profession and become a paramedic, there is absolutely no question it will change you. It's impossible not to be affected by what you see and do. But I think, you know, I've got a young niece who's just starting the job, and my advice to Braden, who's, you know, one of my friends, and anyone else that will listen to me, and I speak to a lot of young paramedics, is that I think what I got wrong as a young paramedic was that as I started, I looked around at people that, you know, mental health wasn't really talked about. It was actually shunned. But I looked at those people and I thought they were putting it on. And I'm ashamed to say that. But, you know, it is real for most paramedics or most frontline workers. It is a cumulative thing. So my advice to people joining the job is that whatever your service offers in terms of psychological first aid and maintenance, to get involved really early. So in Victoria, we have a SMART program. So every year you can speak to a psychologist. I can't stress how important that is. I think even anyone in the job can create a caring environment and caring culture. And I work at Latrobe Valley, and I've worked in a lot of really great teams over my career, but the group of seven paramedics that I work with now are just simply exceptional. And then what we've done is we've created this caring environment where we care for each other, and we genuinely do. No one's got an agenda, so no one at the base has a job I want, or I'm not competing against for anything, but we genuinely care for each other. And what will happen when I work is if someone does a terrible job, the text will go out, "Hey guys, heads up, Ben did a really bad job." And Ben will be supported by each of us. And debriefing cases with peers, I find really, really powerful. Now, we have a peer support program, take advantage of that. But what I find more important or more helpful to me is debriefing it with people who, by the grace of God, it wasn't them going to that, you know, that child who was stabbed to death. You know, it's being able to compare that and speaking to a colleague who knows the very unique pressures that are associated with my job, I find really important. I think things like maintaining a good level of fitness is really important. You know, as you've heard in the podcast, Alex, you know, the book did come accidentally, I think, really. I started writing the book after the Bali bombings, essentially. We got caught up in the second Bali bombings. And I learned very quickly that was a really powerful tool for helping me maintain my mental health. And the difference of thinking about something often and then writing about it, it just waters it down dramatically for me. And despite having written the book, I still keep a journal and I still write. So I encourage people to do that. I think we also need to have a really good understanding of what are the common signs to be worried about in the pre-hospital world, and self-medicating either on pharmaceuticals or alcohol is pretty common. So keeping your eye out like that. And, you know, are you okay day? We have, obviously, in Australia, that should be every day. And if you're worried about a friend, you should reach out for them. For me personally, you know, there was a moment in my career where I got to a point where I stopped working for a period of time. I actually, there was a period I thought I'd never come back to work. It was relatively brief. But I'd never really gone and seen a psychologist. And I went and saw one, and she said some stuff to me, which I actually thought was a load of rubbish. And she said some quite terrible things about the people I worked with and the profession itself. So it just didn't work. And I sort of given up on that theory, and a good friend of mine encouraged me to go again. And I met a lady who, you know, I make the a comparison of, it's like finding a partner. You might have to go on a few dates, but once you find a good psychologist, it can be really powerful. And I've got a lady that looks after me. I know how to manage my mental health now. So this lady, she was actually the person who introduced Trauma Dogs to Australia. She did her PhD over in New York. She's a lovely lady. And I go in and speak to her, and I walk out and I feel 95% better every time. And but I also know now that I need to make those phone calls, whereas in the past that was difficult. So, you know, my advice to my niece and to Braden and to you, Alex, and anyone else is to reach out. And if you're thinking about things, just speak to them. And even when you do the SMART programs, to sit down with someone and they say, "No, you seem to be traveling okay. That's cool. You're talking about it with a professional." And I think that starts the discussion. Your generation is a lot better at dealing with mental health than my generation. So that's in your favour. But I also think, and I might offend people here, I don't think you have the resilience. Your generation has the resilience that my generation does. And that's because we as parents have told our kids that they can do anything they want, and that if in grade three, if someone stole one of Lockie's cookies out of his lunchbox, I'd go down to the school and I'd speak to the principal. And, you know, back in my day, that was just, you know, it was sort of how it was. So I think we, as a generation of parents, have been a little bit too protective in creating resilience for young people. People can disagree with that if they like, but that's my opinion. But I think acknowledging it often and speaking to people, and you create that environment for yourselves and your colleagues and friends, and you'll be fine.
That's really, really great advice, because that was one of the things that caught me on that podcast, that caught my attention with you, is, yeah, we don't have a lot of resilience in our coming generations. I guess we're going into a profession where it's going to be challenging, and we know that. In terms of for the profession, what types of things do you think that students should be starting to do now whilst they're at uni to build resilience?
Well, I think an interesting one for us in Victoria, so I am associated with Monash, so I'll declare that now. But one of the things that, so the biggest employer obviously in Victoria is Ambulance Victoria, and Ambulance Victoria made a request to the Melbourne-based universities to give the student paramedic group some education and some training around receiving feedback. And we've got this issue where we try and give people critical feedback, and they don't cope well with it. So what I would say for the young paramedics now is, I think that you need to listen to the feedback. The people that do exceptionally well in any profession are people who actively seek feedback. So when you do your placements and you're working with people, ask them their opinion. And if we're in a room full of people and we said, who wants feedback? We'd all put our hand up. Yeah, yeah, we all want feedback. The reality is we all want positive feedback. Now, where does the learning opportunities come in terms of feedback? The best learning opportunities comes from the constructive, or, you know, if you do any teaching about feedback, you're not allowed to say negative feedback because it's a no-no word. But the critical feedback and the negative feedback is where the learning comes from. It's also looking at your failures. You know, when I debrief people, I struggle when you say to people, so we arrived and the patient didn't have a drip in. Oh, yeah, I was about to do that. Okay, so we need to probably put that, yeah, I was about to do that. And the people become defensive with feedback, even if you don't agree with it. And I seek feedback from a lot of people, and sometimes I don't agree with their feedback, but I listen to it and I take it away and I analyse it. Sometimes I dismiss it. I go, I don't agree with it. But what I'm challenging the students to do is to listen to the feedback. And if you're not sure about it or you don't agree with it, cross-check it. And one of the greatest wake-up calls for me as a young Mike intensive care paramedic was that I spoke to someone about a job that we'd done together. I said, what feedback have you got? And he said, oh, you know, we did this well. I said, I'm not interested in the positives. I think that's good for building confidence, but I want to learn. So what you know, constructive feedback? And he said, oh, you can be a bit aggressive. I went, oh, that's ridiculous. I've never been aggressive in my life. And then I spoke to one of my mentors. I said, oh, you know, now this guy said I could be aggressive. And he laughed. And I said, what are you laughing? He goes, you are aggressive. I went, no, I'm not. And then it dawned on me. Yes, I was. So in terms of, you know, becoming better, you need to take the feedback on and learn from it. And also I think for the student groups, we must acknowledge and we must embrace this culture of self-reflection. Where am I at? Where are my strengths? Where are my weaknesses? One of the things that I've done, and I've been doing this for 34 years, is we keep a flight book. Every flight we do, you know, we record where we've been, what we've gone, what the patient was. So what I always do is that I go and write down the learning points from that. So my self-critique of that case. And I used to only do the negatives, but sometimes being overcritical of yourself can be damaging. So I also now I acknowledge what I did well in the case. So I have, if you open my flight book up now, there'd be all these post-it notes of, more system, review, whatever. I opened it up a few months ago and it said, don't be a dickhead. I'm not sure what happened that day, but something must have been pretty bad from my point of view. But so self-reflection and seek feedback and embrace your failures. So we have a history in ambulance that the expectation of the public, the patient, our employers is that we get everything right all the time. And that's just simply not possible. So that when we make mistakes, we don't want to hide them. We want to embrace them and we want to learn from them. Because if you fail and you don't learn from it, that's simply a failure. the best lessons in life come from your failures.
I think that is honestly really good advice, and especially about how strong reflection is on your practice and making the clinical decisions for future future cases. So I'd just like to get you to talk through with us about what made you want to take that step into paramedicine and then that step into MICA. Was there a calling? Did it come to you in your sleep that I'm going to become a paramedic? Or was it more of a, this is just a path I'm going to do rather than getting a trade? Or what's the go?
So my journey was that I had a next door neighbor who was a paramedic, and he would work from home. So he was a core branch. And so I got that, I guess the seed was planted from him. Unfortunately, when I was, wanted to become a paramedic, you had to be 21. And so I wrote to the Geelong Ambulance Service, it was where I lived at the time, and said, how do I, best prepare myself for getting a job as a paramedic? And they said, become a tradesman. So I became a fitter and turner, and I hated every minute of it. It was a terrible job. But, on the day I turned 21, I was lucky enough to get become a paramedic. I've always, I guess, in terms of the demographic of the people who work on the helicopter, they're probably the people that are a little bit overconfident. I'm probably not in that mold. I've probably lacked confidence. So I've never really thought I'm smart enough. I looked at some of the intensive care paramedics around and doubted that I was smart enough. But I also am relatively stubborn, and I was challenged, and I was told I was not good enough to be a paramedic. And I remember saying to someone once, well, I'll show you, I'll become an intensive care paramedic. And I'm not as smart as a lot of the people that did that course back in the day, but I was determined, and I attacked the study, and I would have studied harder than most of the people in my cohort. And it's the same as when getting onto the helicopter, I always had a bit of doubt that I'd be smart enough to do it. I looked around at some of the people I looked up to, and but again, I was challenged and told I probably wouldn't be smart enough to do it. So I wanted to prove them wrong. So that's probably being stubborn as a driving force in my life. I was raised in a household that had, we're working class family, didn't have much, but I was always raised that you will help people. And I think that calling of being raised in that way would draw you to a profession like paramedicine.
That's interesting that you decided to go into the helicopters, considering you do mention quite a few times that you are afraid of heights.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting that you picked that, especially when you're getting winched out on a skinny little rope all the way down to the ground.
It's actually a really crazy thing. So we fly through the city, and I look at the people in the cranes and I get sweaty palms. But yet, if you'd asked me, if we pulled up in a hover opposite the crane and I said, open the door, I would. Phobias are stupid. Mine's no different. But, the winching part of it, I absolutely love, but I enjoy being winched in, but I do not enjoy being winched out. And we get to points where they stop the winching and they do power checks and things like that. And I almost feel like screaming down the radio, for Christ's sake, just get me up. I think if you go and become a flight paramedic, most of us have an Achilles heel or two. Some people don't like the water. Some people don't like working on the planes. Some people are frightened working on airplanes. I don't particularly enjoy it. They're particularly harsh and turbulent. So we've all got little Achilles heels, and that's part of the challenge. You've got to overcome your own little phobia here or there.
And with that fear, I guess, so you go to cases, was the cliff rescue, and you got into the water and you lost your communication with the people at the top of the cliff. And then also when you were doing a hiking rescue where you fell into the water and lost more communication.
Sound like I'm a very good paramedic there, does it?
No, but how do you deal with that, that almost that moment of I'm freaking out, I've just lost all my communication? How do you keep level-headed in that situation?
Well, again, I think the people that I admire in my job are the people that are the problem solvers. And, we go to a lot of really crazy, strange scenarios, and a lot of times you go and paramedics are perplexed about how to manage this, but the people that I work with seem to have some clarity around problem solving. So in terms of when we go and do a winch rescue, the planning that goes on prior to that it would be great for you to be able to video the discussion and the brief that we put into one of those cases, because it's quite, I find it quite fascinating. But we always have, we talk about contingency planning, so we always have plans around multiple scenarios. And even when we depart, we might be going up. I was flying up to a case just the other night, and we had, I think we got down to plan J, and we discussed all these different scenarios based on the information in hand. And of course, you get there and the information that you had is wrong or incomplete. So those plans all might be scrapped, or you might adapt two of them together. So we always have a no comms plan when we do winching. So we talk about if we lose total comms, and losing, despite the world that we live in terms of technology, communication in rescues is still the number one issue. And if you look down at where we have our problems and where our errors come from or our mistakes are made, they're always based around lack of communication, lack of information or ability to communicate.
That's really interesting, because I guess that would be, I guess, one of the things I'd fear is not being able to communicate, hey, I've got a really sick patient down here, let's get them up. But you mentioned too that you do put a bit of faith into some other people as well when you're winching up, and you have to have, you know, people holding a line so you don't twist around with the stretcher and things like that. And I guess that's a nice segue into the teamwork and putting your trust into others and just trusting that other people will do their job efficiently as well.
Well, we're very fortunate. So we only hire the company that subcontracts for us only hires the very, very best of people. A large percentage of the people that are flying our helicopters are ex-military pilots. You know, one of my pilots is a Chinook pilot who had a mechanical fire and crashed his helicopter in Afghanistan. Another one of our guys was awarded the Bronze Star by the American military after getting some special forces troops out of when they're under fire. So exceptionally talented people. And sometimes I'm very humbled when I stand, you know, alongside them. But we invest enormous amounts of money into training. So the rough cost of operating an AW139 is about $2 a second. And if you think about that, we go and do a winch practice and it might be 40 minutes of flying, the cost is staggering. But, you know, we're fortunate. We're not volunteer organisations. We're not rattling tins to fly. We're well-funded. We have the state-of-the-art equipment. And if there is a problem with a training or the equipment, then the money will be spent. You know, we're like everyone else in health. We've got to be financially responsible, but we will spend them, and we train. So, you know, we are very lucky. I think the interesting thing about working in teams is that if you take that away from the helicopter, I mean, we are very much reliant on each other and working through the problems together. And I would say that's the number one thing I love about my job, is being in those high stress jobs where everyone is reliant on each other. But I think when you go down and you look at, you know, a 10-year case as a paramedic, and, you know, often I walk in and we'll have some intensive care paramedics and some advanced life support paramedics, and then we often have the students there. It's about how we build the team. And I spoke before about going through and doing your assessment, and after you've done your assessment, your treatment priorities fall out of it, and then exploiting the skill sets of the people there. So we don't want our intensive care paramedics putting on traction splints. We want that to be done by LS paramedics. But when you're running a team and you've got some complex problems, or the patient's deteriorating, or you've got multiple patients, part of the job is to go back and assess your team and see how they're performing. And sometimes we need to guide and support people. We forget, you know, that often that on the helicopter we see a lot of the big trauma, whereas the student paramedics or new paramedics, they might have ever seen a patient being placed into induced coma. So part of our role is to coach and teach, but there's also a part of where there comes a time when you need to substitute some of your team members out because the person's not able to perform, and that upsets people, but that's the reality of the business we're in. If you're not able to do the job that's been asked upon you, you know, you'll be substituted.
So definitely understand that there's, like, you get sidelined and if you're not performing the job. But is that your call then to do that? So as a Micah Flight paramedic, you go in and you run the scenario, like run the scene, as well as perform all those advanced life-saving interventions. Or is there another person there that runs it and controls the whole scene and makes sure that everyone's working to their best of their abilities and doing the right job?
So the way that I run my scenes is, you raise a really good point, Bryn, because the clinical oversight and responsibility remains of the senior clinician, which is often us. But there are times when you need to do things like ultrasounds, probably one of the best ones. When you do an ultrasound on someone, it requires task focus. So you lose your situational awareness. Or if you're putting in an art line or doing finger thoracostomy. So what I would do then is I would typically give the responsibilities of overseeing the clinical management of the patient to the most senior clinician, supernumerary to me. So that's something that I would do often. But most of the time it is us. And I think the one that I would change, where I would change people around often is, and you know, the simple, what we would probably think is a simple skill, but seems to be something that people have trouble with, is bag valve masking. So if you're a paramedic and if you're not maintaining the airway and you're not able to ventilate the patient, then I'll give you some coaching. But if you're still having problems, then I'll swap you out. And that upsets people, but you know, I'm happy to come back and work with them later about that. But you know, if you're trying to prepare someone and increase their fitness for intubation, we need that job to be done and done well. I think that, as I said before, often we go to those big jobs, which is not overly foreign to me, but it would be foreign to some new people. So there is some times we need to do the coaching. And again, you talk about advice to students. So I think in our state, they wear green overalls. If you go to those jobs, get involved, stand over. If you stand away, or if I look up and I see you on your phone, you'll never get involved in a case that I'm managing. But if you're looking interested or ask, is there anything I can do? I'm really keen. I think, you know, I'm obviously happy to be here talking to the Student Paramedic podcast, and the students are our future. We must teach them. So it's really important. But at the same time, if you're doing a job and you can't do it properly. The other one that I see often is when I ask people in Victoria to put a CT6 traction splint on, I would say that probably 30% of the time I ask paramedics to put a traction splint on, they don't know how to put it on. If you want to come to those jobs and you want to, get in with the team, know how to do your basic stuff.
Yeah, I definitely understand that working on your basics is the most important part of the job. And as you said before, like your Dr. ABC is, like, even you revert back to that in your 30 plus years in this career. What recommendations do you think for a student paramedic wanting to come through? And I understand that a lot of student paramedics out there, their goal, their lifetime position in this degree is to become a flight paramedic. It's the highest point, and it's kind of like royalty in this profession, I feel. What do you think that students can work on to try and better themselves as an ACP level, but also to then strive and keep working towards that intensive care paramedic role?
Well, obviously, I mean, you've just got to be good at what you do, and you've got to be dedicated and committed, and you've got to have that self-reflection. You've also got to have that ability to get that feedback and continue to grow and master your craft. So, you know, we look around and, you know, I've been a paramedic for a long time, and I often go to scenes where I walk away and go, wow, that ALS paramedic was impressive, all over it. You know, succinct, concise handovers, and being diligent and being able to do skills. You know, one of the things that I've seen creep in to the Victorian system is that we often go to cases now where there's no IV in, and people just using intranasal, opiates, or we're now giving ketamine intranasally as well. I mean, you know, if you want to impress the people, you know, be a master of your craft, and putting an IV in someone is something within your skill set. And, you know, we don't always get them, but certainly have a try. Present your patients well, give people confidence. When you present your patient well and they're well plumbed, they're well packaged, and you give a handover and it's concise, you know, I look at that with confidence. Whereas if you get there and the patient's not well presented, the handover's poor, you know, I'm going to sit there and go through and really examine, you know, the patient in details. Whereas when you have those people that are really sharp, you know, you go away with an air of confidence that they've got this well managed, and you listen to what they're saying. And you know, when you do handovers, there are times when you give handovers at hospital that they don't hear a single word you say. If the patient's well presented, well managed, the people will listen to what you've got to say.
And so, with now talking about teaching and things like that. Is that what you're planning to do in the future? Or because where does the line stop for you in terms of continuing to work as a microflight paramedic?
That's a good question, Alex. I've been teaching pretty much my whole ambulance career, and you know, I'll always come back to that. I'm 54 now. I still work very hard to keep a level of fitness so that I can do my job. Unfortunately, there's nothing really else that interests me much in ambulance in terms of career pathways. So my plan at this point is to try and do it until I'm 57 or 58, if I'm physically able to. I will not compromise patient care. So if it gets to a point where I don't think that I'm able to deliver it, be competent in my role, I will step aside. But that's my plan, and then it'll be straight into retirement.
Very nice. So I guess that sums it up really nicely, and we don't want to spend too much of your time. I know you're a busy man. So we had three questions that we're asking every guest that we have on, and hopefully to give students a bit of diversity in the answers so that they can take something away from each person. So our first one really ties off nicely to what we've talked about in terms of mistakes. So it's, what mistake have you made that has resulted in your greatest learning?
So I think one of the greatest mistakes that I made was I was involved where if I didn't kill a person, I certainly accelerated their death. And so in short, it was a man who, sorry, I take it back. So I'm massively into the self-reflection. And one of the things I never had confidence on as a young intensive care paramedic was chest auscultation. And in my self-reflection, I went through and acknowledged that every time I'd made a diagnosis based on auscultation, I was correct. So I was therefore going to back myself in and be a bit more confident with that skill. I went to a man who was unconscious with severe respiratory distress. It was an unfortunate time in ambulance. I found myself as 1 year post doing the intensive care course. I was now a clinical instructor, which was, it was just there was advancement and restructuring that was probably unreasonable and unfair on the patient, me and my student. But so I was very junior, and I went to this man, and I thought I could hear that he had wheezes. I thought it was asthma, and I didn't complete my entire respiratory status assessment. I shortcut everything, and we treated him quite aggressively for asthma. He wasn't getting better. We put him on adrenaline, and we gave him adrenaline, and we rushed him to hospital. I took him in, and I developed, I think, a good reputation with the local hospital I worked at, and I gave him the diagnosis, which I had that clinical respect that they continued down that pathway. And shortly after we arrived, the man arrested and died. But he had a chest x-ray done whilst in the interim, and the radiologist came in and said, oh, that chap is obviously full field APO. And I was devastated. I'd got it wrong. And when I went back and reflected on that error, the information was all there. The diagnosis was there for me to see, but I focused on one part of the clinical building, the wall, so that one piece of information, the auscultation. So I failed to follow my system, and as a result, I was led down the path of giving adrenaline to a man who was in cardiogenic shock and having an AMI. So we didn't have 12 leads back in the day, and in APO and. He died, and it almost finished my career. But I learned from that to reflect and make and follow my system, which was the big lesson. But probably the greater lesson for me was to acknowledge sometimes that you don't get it right, and that's okay, and you have to learn from it. As long as you learn from it and become a better paramedic, that's the important part of it. It took me a long time to do that, and that self-flagellation of making a terrible error, as I said, almost cost me my career.
And what does that process of reflection look like for you? So do you talk about the case, and then do you go, these are the things I did well, these are the things I didn't do well? Is there a specific process that you have?
I always focused on the negative. So it was always about the things I hadn't done well. But as I said, I think that always focusing on the negative can be a little bit destructive, particularly if you're particularly critical of your own performance, which I am. So now for me, I also acknowledge the things that I do well in the case. And as I said earlier, I every case I do on the helicopter, I do those three positives and three negatives. And even if it's a minor case, following your system. And it's interesting, quite often it's the same things that I write down. Lack of repeating systematic review is often one. So you know how you have that acknowledgement that you have that experience base. So you walk up and you look at the patient and go, I think it's this, without even laying hands on them. And 99% of the time you're right. That's such a dangerous thing. Not following system is such a dangerous thing.
I think that's going to lead very well into our next question. But if there's one take-home point that you could give to the student paramedics listening, what would that piece of advice be?
I think the piece of advice would be to, it's okay to make a mistake. The expectation on you has never been greater. We have never had more paramedics in the system than we do now. So your ability to get exposure to work is reduced. And, you know, that it's hard. How do we expect people, we give them this guideline book, which is now so big no one can remember it. But if you've never seen someone in, severe asthma, how do we expect them to get it right all the time, every time? I think it's okay to make a mistake, long as you learn from it. And that's the key.
That's really, really great advice, actually. We'll be taking that on board for sure.
Definitely.
So our last question is, what did you used to think to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
I used to have a bit of a, I used to really look up to the people on the helicopter and I put them on a pedestal. And now that I work on the helicopter, there's no pedestal. They're just paramedics like you guys and me. And I also acknowledge that, you always got to be nice to the tea lady, because you might meet a junior paramedic, and certainly being around for 34 years, that junior paramedic might be your boss one day. So treat everyone with kindness and you'll be rewarded.
That is a really good insight. I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much, Darren Hodge, for coming in and chatting to us about being a Mica Flight paramedic, building resilience, and just the power of reflection and that systematic approach. You can find Darren. He has a book out at the moment, A Life on the Line. It's a paramedic's memoir of just calls that he's been to. Both Alex and I have read it, and we really recommend it to all student paramedics, even paramedics out there. I was there whilst Darren was writing this book, and he looks a lot less stressed now, bit less gray hairs on top.
Short haircut, but
definitely recommend reading this book. Darren, do you just want to say where we can find your book?
You can find the book on darrenhodge.com or any of the big book sites will have it, but I'd just like to say thank you for having me. I wish you, all you students, the very best. Remember, as you go through your, student time, think outside the square. Think about how you're going to make yourself more marketable to an ambulance service. We know that there is far more students than there are paramedics. So think about volunteering and going to all the conferences and working at the conferences and starting podcasts up and things like that. So I wish you guys all the best, and when we cross paths, if any of the Victorian people listening, please come up and say hello. And when you go to jobs with people, get involved and get interested and ask if there's things to do. You'll be, I've had lots of students do things like put nasogastrics in, people that were intubating, and putting blood up and bag valve masking people that are intubated. So you've just got to put your front foot forward and get in there and have a go.
Thank you for listening to the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and feel free to email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.